This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Catherine.
Yes.
Too eager. No, let's go again. Catherine, we are only recently back from a delightful little sojourn to our musk retreat.
Yes. I didn't. I keep doing that. I'm too eager.
That's okay. You're allowed to be eager. What were you working on there?
So we've mentioned this before, retreat twice a year. Yep. We do a short one first half of the year and a week long one second half of the year. This one was a quick one for me because I'd already been away for 2 weeks.
You've been gallivanting.
So I was there for less than 48 hours.
Less.
But it was very quick.
Did you make those 48 hours
it was
crazy?
It was very fun. I sent my first draft of my second book to text at the end of September. I thought I'd have a month off. Mandy called me after 2 weeks because she was going on leave and said,
get back to work.
Basically, I'll give you proper feedback soon, but for now, work on this.
Okay, great.
So I was sort of actioning that.
So just tell us very quickly, what does that look like? Like you were on the computer the whole time?
Yep.
Are you working on a document in a spreadsheet?
I was doing a spreadsheet.
Okay.
So just mapping what happens when and trying to make things happen more dramatically, more quickly.
And what will be the next step?
So that, I think my aim at the end, and I had already at that point been working on it for probably 10 days, was to have a scene by scene plan.
Awesome.
So, and I did that. So that was good.
It is, time expands there. It's this really magical, I don't know what Kathy does. She does something to that property so that time actually just kind of
beautiful. It's just a nice.
Yeah, the lands with gamble everyone. And the.
You were also working on edits, but your edits were more specific.
I had a copy edit. Like it's kind of, I'm kind of doing structural copy at the same time. And so I had to get the copy edit express posted to the Daylesford post office, which was so exciting to go in and pick up. I felt very rightly wandering in from the retreat to down the main street of Daylesford to pick up my copy edit. And that was really delightful just to see markup again on the page. And it's partly delightful because, and I said this before, I carry around my copy edit of Skylarking not every day, like not with me constantly.
You don't?
Not in my bag. But when I go to schools and when I'm working with kids and to show them like this is what a...
It's amazing how marked up they are.
Yeah, they're so marked up. And I think this is part of the process I'm in that I'm doing a bit of a kind of major rewrite of one particular aspect of the book. And I love when editors, they want to make you feel brave, right? They want to make you feel like you can do it. So on my copy edit, there's all these like nice little love this. This is great. So true. And I hadn't necessarily had so much.
You even attach to that at uni and stuff, don't you? Not the general
Definitely.
When someone does a love this bit, you become suddenly very attached to that bit.
Yeah. But gosh, also just that capacity to like flip over a page or go, oh my gosh, that chapter looks pretty good. I don't have to read that for the 8,700th time.
It's pretty hard to read. Yeah. I didn't read towards the end. I just, like some of the proofs coming back from the States and stuff, I didn't read.
Obviously why that mathematical equation error is, let's not go back there. Catherine's face just
me. But anyway,
just fell. We have got something a little bit different today on our episode. We have our live recording of the panel session that I did in Sydney without Catherine because she couldn't come and she was sorely missed. And all the people kind of walked into the room and was like, where's Catherine? Because they just assumed that we worked together. The delightful thing. So this was an event at Glee Books in Sydney with a number of writers, Ashley Kalagian-Blunt, Cassie Hamer, and John Purcell. And what was terrific, though, the conversation's great. I really enjoyed the conversation. But this little gang in the room, and there were people who listened to the podcast and were like, oh, it's so funny to see you because I know your voice so well. And that's when I go, my gosh, people listen to us. Like sometimes when we're rambling.
It was
like
actually
this.
Awesome talking to you after that
yeah,
event.
I was
you
pumped.
Were, yeah,
I was
you were very, very
Yeah,
pumped.
I was really pumped because also what we envisaged right at the start was people making connections. And, you know, some of those people, I think they went and had a drink together, like authors, meeting authors. It was, I could have cried. And we also ran a fantastic workshop, How to Podcast, which was less kind of technical stuff, but more concept and putting things and logistics and how you put things together. And a couple of writers in there, but lots of other really interesting people with fantastic ideas. And I'm so excited to see them kind of come to fruition. And hopefully we will, we're looking at getting that workshop to different places in the country next year. But for now, take a listen to our live event. Thank you all so much for coming. It's very exciting for us to be here. I want to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners and custodians of this land that we're meeting on tonight, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. And I'd like to pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. Enormous thanks to Glee Books for having us. This was a bit of one of those emails that I sent out going, so I'm coming to Sydney. Be amazing if we could do an event. And so they very delightfully said, sure, go for it. Bit of an experiment, which I think is a lot of what we have to do as writers. I'm enormously glad to have these three who I've rustled onto the stage and some other authors in the audience, which is very exciting. And so hopefully when we get to questions, we can work out who everyone is. So I am joined tonight by Cassie Hamer, Ashley Kalajian-Blunt and John Purcell. I'm going to give you a bit of an intro for each of them and then I'm going to let them talk about their books in a minute. Cassie Hamer has a background in journalism and PR. In 2015, she completed a master's in creative writing and went on to achieve success in numerous short story competitions. Her debut novel, After the Party, I've got them here, so I'm just going to get you to hang on to yours, After the Party with that gorgeous cupcake, was published in 2019. Welcome, Cassie. Ashley Kalajian-Blunt is the Sydney author of My Name is Revenge. Ashley, can you hang on to yours?
I can.
Thank you. A literary thriller novella. My Name is Revenge was a finalist in the 2018 Carmel Bird Digital Literary Award and was shortlisted for the 2019 Woolara. Is that how I say it? Mm. Digital Literary Award. Ashley's writing also appears in Griffith Review, Sydney Review of Books, The Australian, The Big Issue, Westerly, Kill Your Darlings and more. I feel like you've nailed them all. Welcome, Ashley.
Thanks.
And John Purcell is a Sydney writer and bookseller under a pseudonym. I don't know if I'm revealing this to anyone in the audience who doesn't know this information. Enjoy if this is the first time you've heard this. Under a pseudonym, Natasha Walker, John wrote a series of very successful erotic novels and then under his own name published The Girl on the Page, thank you, John, in 2018. He lives in Sydney at the moment with his wife, kids and a large group of animals. My name is Kate Mildenhall. This is my book. So these are the rules. I'm in charge. I am going to hopefully hypnotise these three authors into telling us all their deepest, darkest publication series, secrets, sorry. Part of what we wanted to do on the first time was to be really candid about what it is first to get published and then to deal with the aftermath of that. Because one of the things we found, or the reason we started the podcast, is because Catherine kept asking me all these questions like, what is going to happen when I sign, and then what is going to happen when the book comes out, and what am I supposed to feel like when I see it in a window, and what about when someone gives me a terrible review on Goodreads, which happens to us all, right?
Oh, yeah.
Do you read them?
Yeah, I read one this morning.
No.
And it was a one star and it was brutal and she detailed in dot point everything
Cassie.
That she hated and said it was the worst book she'd ever read. But I've got to the point where I found it quite amusing.
Yes.
It's like bashing up a marshmallow. Like, it's a book, you know.
If you're going to spend
chill, babe.
That amount of time. Ashley, do you read them?
I haven't gotten any bad ones yet.
Great. Great. And don't keep looking. John, what about you? I know you read them.
I read them, yeah.
They're compulsively?
All the time. Non-stop. I'll go back and reread them because just for the pain of it.
Ashley, you might like to sell this. Ashley also works for Writing New South Wales, and recently Writers Victoria, we did an event that Bram Presser actually set up where we all got together at a bar and we read out our one-star reviews.
I love that.
It was brilliant. So therapeutic. It was really incredible. And everyone, you could see everyone was like, oh, what am I going to do? And then by the end of it, they were like tossing their hair. Yeah. Like, this was my worst. Terrible review. Yeah. So it's going to be an annual event. Maybe next year you can come down.
I'll come.
For it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay. This is what we're going to, we're going to start with the first piece of writing you ever had published. Cassie, do you remember what it was?
Yes, I have it here.
Show and tell.
In fact, yes. So what I'm holding up is
a
1988 version of Dance Australia magazine. I was 12 years old.
For this.
I was obsessed with ballet and was just coming to the realization that I had zero talent and zero flexibility. So instead of actually doing ballet, I wrote a poem about it.
Would you?
Do you want me to read a bit of it?
Yes, please.
It is suitably dreadful.
Nah, as it should be.
With way too many adjectives.
Oh my
gosh.
Okay,
here we go. The performance. The curtain sweeps in a spectacular motion. The lilting melody exudes from the orchestra pit. Graceful movements are executed with precision and beauty, whirling and swirling till the story comes to a tragic end. The applause thunders in the theatre. Curtain calls are numerous. Was it worth all the hours of hard work and toil? Of course it was. End poem.
I love it. Do you remember how you felt when you saw that imprint?
Yeah, I felt awesome. I
felt
really...
Addictively so?
Well, okay, so I think I then rested on my laurels for the next 26 years because that's how long it took for me to get another creative piece published. So,
Hit your peak really early then.
Yeah.
Dance magazine.
Exactly, yes.
Amazing. Thank you for bringing Show and Tell.
Pleasure.
Ashley, what about you?
I have Cassie beat by a few years. My first publication was when I was 7.
Ooh, overachiever. Total overachiever. Tell us.
It was a little short story called The Wizard Who Had a Cat. It was published in Young Saskatchewan Readers, which was like a compilation of the best creative writing from years one, like kindergarten through 12, in Saskatchewan, I guess. I don't even know. I have the book at home in Canada. But it's, I think, was widely plagiarized from a picture book. I don't know which picture
all
book at this
is.
Point, but... But yeah, it was about a wizard who turned all the kids in his class into frogs. I'm not sure where the cat came in. It's lost its time at this point. But.
And did you want to be a writer at that stage? Was that...
People told me I was good at it, and then that happened, and then I just got in my head that, like, yeah, of course I'm going to be a writer, which was a terrible thing to get in my head at the age of 7, because it meant I didn't work hard at it for a long time, like a long time.
I think that happens to a lot of writers. I say that to students that I'm teaching writing to all the time. Like, you're the best writer in your class, right? You're not always going to be the best writer in your class, and failure is going to hit you really hard when you get out into the big wide world. What was the distance for you? 26 years before you were published again?
No. I was published a bunch in like the university and college newspapers I attended, and then I moved to South Korea and I did some, like, there was a bunch of English language publications there that were easy to get published in, so I did that.
We'll put that in our hot tips. Move to South Korea.
Move to South Korea.
Easy to get published there. Thank you. John, what about you?
I had to wait all the time until I was 40. So I wrote in silence and in rejection.
Pain.
In pain for all that time. And so my first publication was my first book, and that was it. I remember entering a couple of story competitions, and the comments on there were so bad. Some of them were actually longer than the pieces that I wrote.
The feedback that you were getting back.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, that's a bit hard. We might start with you because you're in the very strange position of having two first novels, really. One under a pseudonym, Natasha Walker, who's obviously not here tonight, and one under your own name. Can you give us the pitch, one sentence pitch or small pitch for both those books, please, John?
Christ.
This wasn't on the email, sorry.
No. So The Secret Lives of Emma is a woman who's married, who decides to marry, and then decides that marriage is a bit dull and ends up having a ton of affairs. That's pretty much Emma. And it goes on for 3 books as she enjoys.
He had a lot of material there.
The girl on the page is more difficult. It's more of a clash between two cultures. There's the commercial fiction writer comes in direct contact with two literary greats. And I found immediately that the story generated itself from there when these two warring parties sort of came together and learnt from each other. And that's pretty much the pitch for that one in the short time you've given me.
I know, sorry. I have sneakily and cheekily talked to John at length already today, and that will be another interview that we put up. And much of what we discussed, really, literary versus commercial, integrity in the literary world, it all comes out in that book there. Ashley, yours is a different beast altogether.
Altogether.
Can you give us the pitch for My Name is Revenge?
Yes. My Name is Revenge is a collection of essays and a novella about the Armenian genocide of World War I and its connections to Australia. The essays tell the history of the genocide through memoir and history and show how it was the blueprints for the Holocaust and why that is not widely known. And the novella is set in Sydney, and it starts with the assassination of the Turkish consul general, which happened here on December 17th, 1980, and revolves around two brothers who get involved in that wave of terrorism.
Great pitch. It's an extraordinary book. I read it really, really I read all of your books really, really quickly. So they are all compelling in their own very different ways. But the gorgeous slimness of My Name is Revenge means that you can sit down in the afternoon and just gobble the whole thing whole. And it's very impressive. We'll talk more about it.
And there's pictures.
And there are pictures as well.
There's pictures.
There's pictures as well. And we'll talk about that difference between big publishers, who have got both here, and a smaller indie press as well. Cassie, tell us, after the party, best tagline ever, really. When I first saw it, I was like, what a great idea.
Initially, it was called The Girl at the Party, but John will understand why I changed it. It's just so...
So many cliche, other connotations.
Yeah,
there.
I mean, with John's book, it's a joke and it's a good joke. With mine, I had to change it. Yeah, so it's the story of a Sydney mother, Lisa Wilden. She's a very normal Sydney mum with two kids. She decides to throw a fifth birthday party, and it's a total disaster from start to finish. So the cake gets smashed. She's invited 32 kids. They destroy the place and the whole thing's a nightmare. But the sting in the tail is that after the party, she discovers a little girl hiding in the dog kennel. And at first she thinks, okay, well, the mum's just running a bit late, it's all cool. But then she gets a note via a birthday gift, and it's from the mother of this little girl. And she says in it, I'm not coming to pick up my daughter, you need to look after her. And so the story follows Lisa's journey of trying to find out who this child is and who the mother is and why she's been entrusted with her care.
Cracking read. They're all cracking reads. Mine is completely different. Mine's historical fiction, so it's just another world entirely based on a true story, which is so I often get to sit down and talk about historical fiction panels. I don't normally get with the big guns who do commercials, so it's very exciting.
And Kate's book is also a cracking read. It's like, I read it very quickly.
Thank you.
I really
yes,
liked it.
Good. I have had one. My best ever experience with a reader was because the book studied in schools a fair bit in Melbourne, and a girl came up in year 9, and I'm a teacher as well, and she just burst out crying and continued to cry. And then her friend came up and said, I'm sorry, she's just really overwhelmed to be meeting you. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's it, I've peaked.
Wow.
Fan moment. Huge. Have you had this is off I'm going off script now as I do fan moments?
No,
not
yet? Like that, no bursting into tears yet.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm going for that with my second book.
Yes. Good. Excellent. Ashley, yours would have a really extraordinary reader response.
I attended a book club on the North Shore that was all Armenian women. And
wow.
I was so nervous about it because I didn't know what the Armenian community's response to this book was going to be, which I can talk about a bit later. But this group was just, it was like getting together with all of my aunts, which was delightful. But they were so, like, it just prompted this incredible conversation, and they were all talking over each other. And they told me at the end that it was the best conversation that their group had ever had. They'd been meeting for a couple of years at that point. So that was really rewarding.
Because that's what we want, right? I mean, you want that reader response, whether it's bad or good. John, you've had both, I imagine. What's your best reader response?
I do get... Because the sex thing won't go away. It's never going to go away.
And only got yourself to blame, John.
I know. And so when I'm sitting in the signing queue with the authors who have queues going out the door, I'll get someone up who comes all the way along down to my empty little spot and tell me their sexual fantasies.
How do you deal with that? That's not something the rest of us you no. write it have down. To deal with.
You take
no.
notes.
No, I do not. These are not worth notes. This is more like, do I call someone?
Yes. Okay. So because also mostly we're very polite to people who've bought our books and
yeah.
So you have to be polite.
Oh yeah.
Wow. That's a. I didn't have that on my questions, obviously, because I feel like that's a fairly unique experience. Tell us, how did you get there, Cassie? How did you get this book into book form?
Oh, it was torturous.
Okay.
Yeah, I feel like everyone in Australia who could have rejected it did reject it.
Okay.
Basically.
Over what kind of period of time?
Over about a year. It's quite funny, actually. Even as the book was going to print, I was still getting rejections.
But did you do Julia Roberts back at them? Like,
I'm like, don't you keep up with the publishing industry? This book's about to hit the shelves. But it was tough, but it wasn't unexpected because I'd been through that process before with other manuscripts. So the fact that it wasn't getting traction didn't shock me. But in the end, I submitted to Harlequin and got chosen off the slush pile. It was like the magical unicorn story, I feel. But it was almost like it was meant to be. Like, I truly believe that getting published is like blind dating. You have to kiss a lot of frogs before you find your prince.
You can tweet that. That's good. That's quotable.
Well, I had to kiss a shit. Can I say that? Shitload of them, anyway, the bastards. And in the end, it was actually a princess who rescued me, and just the publisher at Harlequin completely got what I was trying to do. And it was like it was meant to be. But getting published is kind of 90% bloody hard work, and then that X factor 10% of luck. And
right
I just
spot,
was
right time.
Bloody lucky. They're growing their list. They're looking for work, and they're just the right fit for me.
Before we move on, Cass, what kept you going through all those rejections that you were getting? What was it that kept you going?
I love writing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it has to begin with, and that's what it has to end with. I mean, truly, I guess what I really love is reading, and I'll always consider myself a reader first and a writer second. And even if this writing caper went away tomorrow, I'd still be a daily reader, and it's just a habit that I can't conceive of life without. But I also did have some belief in the story. It had been such a joyful process to write, and it felt good, and I could see myself doing this for many, many years to come. And I always, the thing that motivates me is just thinking about myself as an 85-year-old woman and looking back on my life and just not wanting to regret not having tried until the very end.
Yep.
And that really helps me. That just always keeps me at the desk and keeps me going. And now that I've got the contract, it keeps me working.
So good. Ashley, what about you? How many times had you put My Name is Revenge out into the world in what forms before it finally became this little book?
My Name is Revenge has a strange story because it wasn't even the original book. It's side projects that came out of a different manuscript.
Wow.
So the project started 9 years ago, and it became a travel memoir of Armenia that looked at its history. And that manuscript was shortlisted for the Kill Your Darlings Unpublished Manuscript Award. It was shortlisted for the Impress Prize Unpublished Manuscript Award in the UK. And publishers kept reading it and kept coming back to me and saying, this is great. It won't sell in Australia.
It's so hard. It's so hard. The writing is good. The concept is good. You've done a great job. We can't sell it.
And probably we could have sold it 15 years ago. Where were you then? I mean, no one said that, but sort of just the way the industry has changed with the internet. That kind of book just, it doesn't sell now. So, but while I was doing that, I was just taking all these side projects out of it. And so like the essays were published in different places, in Sydney Review of Books and in Griffith Review. And so then when I wrote the novella, I submitted it to which the novella is only 12,000 words. The novella is not very long. So I submitted it to a competition, and the competition invited you to include an essay about the writing of that piece. So I wrote an essay about the history behind it and what had led me to write it. And it was shortlisted for that prize, which included digital publication. And then the publisher came to me and she said, we love this. We really want to publish it in print form. It's not long enough to have a spine.
Okay, that's literally the problem. It was too short to have a spine.
It was too short to have a spine.
Write your books long enough to have a spine.
Well, but that was fine because then she said, like, she actually asked if I had other fiction that would tie in. But I said, I've got all these other essays that actually would sit really well together. And then we put photos in it from my time in Armenia. And it just came together really, really beautifully. Like, it was just, considering that I have written 5 other manuscripts.
Yes.
That this collection of side projects ended up being my first book. I never would have seen coming. That was a real surprise.
And it is such a it's a beautiful form for the moment as well, when they're saying, you know, you cannot afford to let someone put your book down and pick up their phone. This is the form in one way for the moment as well. What's happening with the other 5 manuscripts? So one of them is the Armenian.
One of them is the Armenian travel memoir, which I've just put aside. One of them is sort of doing the rounds of submissions right now.
Fingers crossed.
One of them I wrote in high school, and it is about killer bees from Mars, and I do not think it is scientifically accurate.
I don't think that stopped people in the past either.
I went back and I found a printed copy of it one year when I was home for Christmas, and I was reading it. It was just so unbearably awful.
But they're okay. They're the ones that we have underneath the bed, right?
Yeah, of course.
Our practice novels.
Another one I wrote in university, which is almost as bad. Not quite, but almost. And then there's another one. Gee, I've written so many, I can't even.
This is a good point to be in. I think Robert Lukens, who wrote The Everlasting Sunday, some people might know it, posted a picture the other day of his stack of manuscripts that he has written. And he said, he showed it to a group of writing students and they were all kind of aghast, like, oh, I don't have to write that many before I get published. And he was saying, no, this is a really important photo to show people that he's written like a book a year since he was kind of 16. They are his practice novels. Thank you, Ashley. John, I know that you had practice novels. You told me this. How did The Girl on the Page make it out into the world?
I was able to get rid of a book that was really hampering my progress. So I had one of those books that a lot of writers get stuck with. They're obsessed with it. They're in love with it. They can't let it go. They rewrite it. They work on it. They try different angles. And I did that for about 7 years on this particular manuscript. And the moment that I actually got an offer from Penguin to do it was the moment I decided I didn't want to do it. It was
Chase.
Yeah, it just seemed all wrong. And so I put it in a drawer, and it was really that moment, after 7 years of messing around, that The Girl on the Page just came to me, and I wrote down an outline. About a page long, I started writing about the characters as if they had been with me all this time, and it just poured out of me. I wrote it so quickly. So for something that took me 7 years, once I got that out of the way, I wrote Girl on the Page from January 2017 to July 2017 on weekends. Wow. It came out in such so easily and well in order. It was compared to what I was, the pain that I'd gone through before. There's a lot of learning that had gone on in between first trying to write the book that didn't get published. I mean, I got published with the erotica by accident, and I had access.
I like how he says by accident. There's another story there, which we'll see if we have.
And the editor on that really taught me a lot. And I was writing for Booktopia a lot, and there was a journalist there when I first joined, who was really good at reducing my verbiage to really short, sharp sentences. So I had two kind of teachers around the same period, the editor at Random House, Bev, and my teacher at Booktopia, Tony.
So much of, I think, that first publication experience and first editing experience is just about learning those things, getting rid of so many words. How many, do you know how many were cut from your book, Cass?
So I submitted a manuscript that was 80,000 words. I ended up rewriting about 20,000, and the final manuscript is 90,000.
Yeah, wow.
So it was pretty substantial. Yeah. But it was good. It's always a much better book, I think, as a result of that process, there's no doubt.
Absolutely. And I think you just learn so much from those editors. Yeah. Editors are one of the people who help us kind of after the process. But one of the questions we get so much is, who the hell got you there? Like, who was helping you get to that publication
that first publication phase? Was it an agent? Was it writing New South Wales? Was it a friend? Cassie, what about for you?
That is a really interesting question, because I think I actually didn't have anyone much in my corner. What I did have was the internet, and I listened a lot to podcasts, and I read a lot of blogs written by writers who were trying to be published or were in that publishing journey. In particular, novelist Natasha Lester had an amazing blog that was called While the Kids Were Sleeping. And so she was a mother of young children, much like myself, which is when I took up writing, was when I had a three-year-old and a one-year-old, which is possibly the most inconvenient time to do it.
It truly is inconvenient.
That whole, it's a phenomenon. The maternity year for novel is really a thing, because it's that chance where you get to stop and think, and you're doing something really tedious, which is raising children. And you get to, you just want to think about other things than feeding and puking and all of that. So a lot of my contact really was online. I didn't get an agent. I didn't have a writing crew. The only person that ever read my manuscript was someone I paid, because I just did not want to impose on anyone. Barely any of my friends read. Didn't have any writing friends. So it was a pretty lonely process, but I was okay with that. I didn't necessarily want to shout it from the rooftops, because that takes a lot of bravery and you have to be quite vulnerable.
Yeah, I think. Absolutely. I've been a big fan recently of Big Magic. Have other people listened to or read Big Magic? Yeah, and I didn't necessarily think that I would like it, and I'm completely and utterly obsessed with it. And I love her, Liz Gilbert's idea of writing as an affair as well. I mean, that's partly to rejig the creative process. But you often hear people who say, yeah, no, I wasn't prepared to tell anyone that I was writing a book.
No, because they look at you like you're a crazy loser, or, you know, like as if you are ever going to have a book published. Like, who do you think you are? That's what you think they're going to say. Actually, most people go, oh, you're writing a book. That's awesome. But it's just all in your head. All these doubts and insecurities just float around and they're on your shoulder all the time. And getting that contract is such a validating experience that completely changes your mindset. Doesn't necessarily change your life. Like, I still get up every morning, make the kids breakfast, send them off to school, do lunches, blah, blah, blah. But it makes me feel like sitting down at the computer is a really worthwhile thing to do, because I know that someone is actually going to read the words.
Yeah, someone's waiting for it. You've been completely validated. It does something to your confidence straight away.
For sure.
What about you two in terms of a writing network? You had this bookish network, John.
Yeah. So
help or hindrance?
Well, one of the people who really helped my progress, even though if you'd asked me the whole way along, I would have said it had no help whatsoever, is Simone, who's sitting over there. She's my agent at the moment. I've known her for years, and she's brutal, absolutely brutal. And so whenever I'd give her a manuscript, it would come back with so many comments, like so many comments. She's the longest email writer you could ever imagine. And I ran every time I saw it. I read it, of course, because I wanted the pain of it. But I often ran in the other direction. But she was willing to look at it seriously and take it seriously, which was always a good thing. I think when she read Girl on the Page, she would have been able to tick off the things. Yeah, I told them that. I told them how to do that. And that was me. I won't ever acknowledge it. Having her around was great, because she wasn't going to just go, yeah, it's good. Or, oh, yeah, I don't know. But, you know, she wrote essays, so I knew where I was going right and knew where I was going wrong, so that was really helpful. My wife was very helpful with this latest book, because of the pain of having to go through reading redrafts and redrafts of a book that I was writing over 7 years. She never wanted to see or be in that part again, so she said, I'll only read it when you have a manuscript
nice
done. And so I wrote really fast, because I really wanted her to like my book. And so
excellent.
I just read it, wrote and wrote and wrote. And finally I gave her a very large pile of pages, and she read it and she liked it. And I was like, thank God.
That's great. I think that sometimes you need to have, my theory is that I send it to someone who I know is going to be a harsh reader and send it to my mum on the same day.
Yeah.
And then I know that like mum will say, it's wonderful.
The most biased feedback
I love you.
Ever.
Exactly. But I know that it just cushions the blow of what's coming my way as well. Yeah. Ashley, who helped you? Who or what helped you?
Right, yeah, writing New South Wales helped me a lot. Just I think I, before I started working there as a member, I think I utilized almost all of their services, I think like their courses, but also their manuscript assessments and all kinds of things. So that was really helpful. And also I joined a writing group through Writing New South Wales that I now run, and they are just, that's amazing. Just getting regular feedback from a group of people and sitting down and talking with them about it. And just now I, when I'm writing, I can hear what they're going to say about various things. Like I know them so well at this point, but that means that I'm editing. Like as I go, I can skip over bits that would just be a waste of time because I can hear their voices in my head. So, but all of those things. And having friends like who are writers and yeah.
That's great. I want to ask about expectations because I think a lot about getting of getting published for the first time and going through the whole process is about managing expectations. Mm. Can you tell me about the day your book came out? Do you remember? What did it look like? What happened on that day? Were there people cheering in the streets or not so much?
Okay. So on the actual day of publication, nothing.
Cricket.
Just nothing. Nothing. I went to work. I came home. I didn't look for the book. Just nothing. But the day before, I'd had an amazing launch of friends and family. And my husband has a retail business in Wallara. And I'd had, 100 family and friends come and we had cake and champagne and I'd nearly not had a launch because I just thought it was the most egotistical thing. Like, oh, come and celebrate my book. It's all
launches blah, blah, blah. Are important to the people in the audience who have books forthcoming.
Please, please have a launch because it honestly was one of the happiest days of my life. Apart from getting married and having children, people were so nice that I felt like I was at my own funeral and it was a really joyous funeral.
Yeah. I think people were nicer to me at my launch than at my wedding.
Yeah,
and it was all about me.
I got to talk to more people.
Yeah, amazing.
And you make money out of it. You're not just spending it all. So, really a memorable day.
Okay, so launch, amazing, day of publication, nothing.
Total fizzer.
Ashley.
Total.
Did you do a launch?
I had a lot. The launch was incredible. The launch Fantastic. Was, yeah, the launch was amazing. It was really great. And people from the Armenian community came and it was just, it was just really wonderful.
Incredible. Did you have to organize that all yourself?
Oh, yeah. And pay for it. Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. So also note.
Yeah. Me too.
But it was totally worth it. Like it was one of the best days of my life. Absolutely.
And then the day of release, were there expectations from you?
So my book came out in stages because of the award that it was involved in. So there was a 1,000-word excerpt that was published digitally sort of 3 or 4 months before it came out. And I was really nervous about that because I hadn't told the Armenian community I was writing about. So the Armenian Genocide 1915 is still denied by the Turkish government. And in the 70s and 80s, there was this wave of terrorism that sort of went around the world, which was a couple of groups of Armenian men, they were the grandchildren of survivors, who decided to try to change the Turkish government's policy by assassinating diplomats and Turkish government officials around the world. And that isn't talked about a lot. Like, I'd been interviewing people in the Armenian community for a number of years and, talked about the genocide at length. This terrorism had never come up, and it wasn't even written about a lot. Like, I just see these little paragraphs about it here and there. And so when I decided to pursue it, I didn't tell anybody. I was very nervous. And there's a political organization here, an Armenian political organization. I did not know how they were going to react to it. And then also there's the Turkish denialists there's a group of them who are very, in here in Australia, who are very active in terms of trying to shut down anyone talking about the genocide, period. So I kind of, like, the Turkish thing, I was like, okay, well, I'm sort of expecting that almost. I'm still kind of disappointed that they haven't reached out to me and told me why I'm wrong. but the Armenian thing I was genuinely worried about because these are people I cared about. And so the day this 1,000-word excerpt went up online, it wasn't like there was huge fanfare around that, but I just thought, someone might see it and then share the link. So I went to work that morning and my phone starts ringing, like my mobile. And I was like kind of doing something. I was like, I couldn't answer. And then it just kept ringing. And nobody calls my mobile, like, ever. And it just kept ringing. And I was just like, oh, no, what's happened? Something horrible has happened.
Someone had obviously shared the link.
No, it was someone from Gumtree who had a wrong number.
That's so disappointing.
That is so disappointing.
It's like the stress that I went through. And when I finally got to listen to the voicemail, I was like, really? Seriously? Today?
On this day of all days.
Yeah.
Far out. Okay. A lesson to us all. John, what about you when girl... Because for your first book, Secret Lives of Emma, obviously that came out and you weren't allowed to enjoy that.
No.
So did you enjoy The Girl on the Page coming out?
Yeah, it was fantastic. And I was in the best place in the world to publish a book. I was working at Booktopia. So, you know, all the best book people were in the room and I had cupcakes. You know, it was great. So it was it was like a second launch.
What did you do for your launch?
We had a launch. HarperCollins organised a launch and Charlotte Wood spoke and all my friends and family were there.
Big Charlotte.
Yeah. And it was great. And all the family and friends and old friends came, all work colleagues came, and it was a brilliant night, as you guys experienced. It was overwhelming, you know, really overwhelming. And it was so different to the last one, because the last one, so few people knew it was me. You know, I just had to watch, you know, just watch the world and be very silent and get a little bit excited. And as it went on, I slowly, like, just had to share the secret and pulled over a colleague and went, that's me.
Did they believe you?
No, at first there was a whole lot of just like, and then slowly they're like, oh, fuck, you're serious. and it was one by one I sort of let them in on the secret. And as the book got, you know, more and more successful, I was getting a bit more comfortable about it. But the publisher still wanted to put out book two and book three, so I had to stay silent in that period. But the first day it came out was glorious. I mean, it was, after all that, I started writing seriously at about 18, 19, wanting to get published. So to get there at 40 and not be able to tell anyone was a real pain.
Very much so. So tell me, when people start tweeting at you and various things, I know that we were already having this discussion just while we're having one before, putting pictures of your book on Instagram, etc., what's your policy? How do you deal with it? What's your sharing policy? What's your thank you policy? Mm. And I asked this because at the very start, I had no idea and I just let it go. And there were all these messages there and I didn't respond to them because I thought, oh,
what, like direct messages?
Some direct messages.
Really?
Well, because I didn't know what you were supposed to do.
Rude.
Well, it was rude. It was rude.
Okay. So
I went back a year later and responded to every single one of them.
Been a bit slow. I don't have a hard and fast policy. If I feel like I'm talking about myself too much, I stop. I'm very hyper-conscious of not trying to overpromote, and I think you guys have spoken
80-20
rule. 80-20 rule. And you're allowed to break that launch time.
Around launch time, you can't do anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Even today, I was just looking back at my Instagram because I wanted to work out what I was doing on launch day, which turned out to be nothing, to see how much I posted. And I felt at the time like I was posting all the time, but it was maybe one thing every 3 days.
Yeah.
Like, it was not incessant, but it felt incessant.
Well, and also, I don't know if you got similar advice. Like, I remember very clearly my publicist saying once a day. I wasn't a big Instagram user, and she said once a day in the month before, and then during the 6 weeks where you get your moment. So you have 6 weeks. Is this true, John? You have 6 weeks where your publicist is doing the thing for your book, and after that, God be with you. Okay, so you don't have hard and fast rules?
No.
Ashley, what about you?
I respond to everybody, absolutely, because it's just delightful to get people to reach out to you. It's just amazing. I try to follow the 80-20 rules. So if I have people post great pictures of my book and I'm like, oh, I really got to share this, which means I've got to share some other people's stuff, which is great because then it just reminds me to go out and be like, okay, whose stuff do I want to share right now?
It does. And also sometimes you need your mates to share those things for you. Mm. I mean, that's the beautiful thing about being in a writing community is they're like, oh my goodness, congratulations, you were shortlisted for, you know, and then you don't have to do it and feel like you're doing the thing. So share them for your mates as well in the writing community. John, what's your rule? I feel like you should be the master here giving us a masterclass.
Well, having had the absolute frustration of dealing with authors who don't do anything and you think, you're looking at their Nielsen sales and they're not that great and you think, well, I can tell you why. Yeah. That's sort of the silence from it. It's a new world, and just a couple of years ago, you would not have seen a certain number of literary authors in Australia even deign to mention their own work. But now it's completely changed. If you don't mention it, your book is gone and the publicist has moved on. So it's now a requirement.
You've got to play the game.
Otherwise you're just gone. And bookshops want you there so they can then share it and they can do things. If you're not there, then it just won't get sold. You won't get seen. So I was over the top. I mean, I just went ballistic. I wanted to be sort of an example of you can still do this and people still will talk to you.
Yeah.
Afterwards. And it does work. It cuts through. You get comments and engagement. I've been watching Trent Dalton do it as well. And he was published, you know, 4 months before me. And I went, he's doing it well.
He's doing it really well. Yeah. He's and I think that's what we talked about this today as well, about the engagement and the relationship between the writer and the readers. And I think that's part of it. When a writer does respond to you, and that's what I wasn't sure of the rules about when Skylarking came out. I was like, I don't know. Are you allowed to? But now that's very clear, yes, you are allowed to speak to your readers. They are allowed to speak to you. That you do need to have that connection. That's part of it.
Yeah. And I think it's a very that's a whole part of social media that people forget is the social side. And you need to be a bit more vulnerable. You need to be a bit open, a bit funny. Try to do what you would do at a function, and you're all standing around with your glasses of wine and just have a bit of banter.
Yeah.
Because people are watching, and it does help if they see someone human. Yeah. Behind it all. And if they're taking nice pictures of your book and going to trouble to take those pictures, because they do, they get lighting
they really
right.
Do.
And they,
Are there bookstagrammers in the audience? People do really nice pictures with
beautiful
books.
The flat lays.
Oh my gosh.
Gorgeous.
I know. Yeah.
People keep posting pictures of my book at the beach. I'm just like, oh, that's nice for it you and
is,
my book.
Yeah, it is difficult as well, depending on content. That must be difficult.
It's lovely of them to do that. I just always get a little jealous.
I think it's true too. You mentioned before about Trent Dalton, and I give that advice to people lots of times. Just watch what other people are doing. Just lurk there for a little bit and just go, okay, that person's doing it really well. I think people like Jane Rawson, who's Frippet on Twitter, she does a great job of being involved in the conversations.
Yeah.
That she wants to be involved in. She does lots of shout outs to people, you know, and so I just watch those people and I go, yeah, I want to be like you.
Yeah, you have to be a giver and not just a taker, for sure. Otherwise, people do get bored of you very quickly, I think. Yeah.
I'm going to ask for questions in a moment, so get your questions ready. And the delightful Ruby is going to bring a microphone down as well so that we can capture them for our live recording. But I want to ask you before we get to that, what are the things that you wish you'd known that first time that you know now for second time?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I was prepared to have a range of feelings, but I didn't realise the intensity of the feelings that I would have. And it really, the gamut of them did range from elation to great sadness to a sense of feeling almost ashamed or embarrassed, or, you know, are people not buying a book? Are they buying a book? And I think sometimes authors jokingly refer to a book as their book baby, but it's not a joke. It so much of it reminded me of new motherhood. Like, there are weeks where I had terrible insomnia and I wasn't eating properly, and I was just constantly in a state of nervous excitement and conscious that this thing that I gestated was now out in the world and I had no control. And I found it very challenging. And it didn't last a long time, that period of great emotional intensity. But I'm hoping with the second book that I don't have to experience it to that degree.
I want to ask you too, I don't want to let you go without asking you about your fantastic blog piece that's on Lee Kaufman's blog that I know has been shared lots of times because I've heard other people talking about it. Can you just tell us about what happened there and this idea of not apologising for your voice?
Yeah, so I wrote about the fact that when I was sending out my book to people, I would send an email saying, I've written this book, it's just a bit of fun, it's nothing serious, it's not War and Peace, but I think you might enjoy it in a page-turning kind of way. And people were lovely and very generous and agreed to read it, but one person did come back to me and say, you need to stop apologising for your book. And it really made me think, because I thought I was proud of the book, but I was absolutely underplaying it, or you know, just trying to, I thought I was trying to set expectations, but what I was conveying was a bit of a sense of shame.
Yeah.
Which was completely not what I had intended to do, but I had a bit of a hangover from having published quite a bit in short fiction, which was a very literary form. I was very conscious that this book was not that. This book is a lot of fun, and it does, I think, I hope, make you turn the page.
It certainly does.
And I think fun is a great thing. I think fun is really important, but I still have this awful little voice in my head that says it's not a valid kind of art form. And I'm still trying to challenge my own kind of prejudice, I guess, around that, because I love reading fun books. You know, I love Leanne Moriarty, I love Marion Keyes, and I love that style of writing. So, you know, in being the way I was, I think I was also not respecting the reader.
Yep.
You know, not respecting my writing and not respecting the reader who likes that style of writing, one of which is me, basically. So that's also I'd had this experience at a writing group that I'd been asked to speak at, and I'd talked about my transition from writing short literary fiction into writing commercial fiction. And this old guy gets up and he goes, "Are you disappointed that you've sold out?"
Yeah.
And I just thought, I haven't sold out. What I felt was a sense of homecoming, that I'd found the natural kind of chatty conversational voice that had always been inside of me but had been beaten down by expectations of what I should be writing rather than just what I wanted to write.
So interesting. And for people interested in that particular conversation, after you've read Cassie's book, you should read Girl on the Page, because it goes into the same kinds of ideas.
Yeah, it does.
Ashley, tell me, what's your advice? What do you wish you had have known that first time that you'll take on board for next?
Here's something I still wish I knew is a question for John. Is
go.
So when you go into a book, like I go into bookshops and I'm so nervous. I'm like, I always intend to be like, oh, I should introduce myself and I should, you know, and then I'm like, nope, not going to do that. Get turn around and walk right back out. So how do you do that as an author?
I don't. I'm terrified.
We're all scared.
Yeah, I walk around bookshops and see the book on the shelf and then sort of scuttle off to the other side, so I'm never caught near my own book. When I'm with a publicist, fine. Alice would take me to the counter and organise a thing. But by myself, no way. I'm never going to go. And Peter went into the new Corn Store, a new Constant Reader in Mossman. And Peter yells out that there is a copy of mine and I should sign it.
Yeah.
And I almost died on the spot. That's kind
but
of thing.
But good on you, Peter. That's, you also need a wingman or wingwoman to do this with you.
Yeah, so it is difficult to do. Every time that anything like that has happened and I have been forced into it, booksellers are lovely. Like, I mean, I dined for 10 years of Booktopia. I went out to dinner with my bookseller friends more often than I went out to dinner with my wife, because there are so many events that you go to as a bookseller. And I got to know everyone, you know, through in bookselling through those years, and got to meet them. And they're just people who love books a lot, enough to take no money for doing their job. And that's all they are. And so when you go to the counter in a bookshop, you're generally 99% going to find someone who's just as obsessed about writing and books as you are. So it shouldn't be scary, but it is.
It is. You can do it.
Yeah.
You can practice here tonight.
Yeah. Well, John, send you down.
What about, I sometimes think maybe you know too much, but is there things that you wish you had known first time around?
The first time around was terrible, and Simone will tell you at length and then in bullet points why my first contract was the worst contract ever given to a writer. I do believe that's held by Dostoevsky, though. It was just naivety and just sheer, like, someone wants to fucking publish me? Signing away.
Which is what we do.
Yeah. And since having Simone as my agent, we've been the most annoying people on the planet for publishers. And I advise the main thing that you need to get in, no matter where you are, is the marketing stuff. You've got to know what they're going to do for you. If they're not going to do anything for you, then lower your expectations, because marketing and placement and relationships with booksellers are key to any publication. If you haven't got all that, then you need to fight for it in your contract. And if they say, oh, but then you're going, why do you want to publish me? You know, if what am I to you if you're not going to put all that effort in? And there are exceptions, because if you've got a niche area, or you're writing a very literary book, there's just the sheer love of the subject that a publisher might go, look, on our spreadsheet, it's probably not going to appear much, that particular book, but I'm obsessed with it. I have to publish it. And they take that as a hit. And if it does go wild, then great. But on the main, you know, they're just doing for the sheer love of the product, of the book that they've got. But yeah, the main thing is, and if you can get a lawyer, thankfully, Simone is a lawyer as well, so she's the most
double
annoying.
Whammy.
The most
You're
annoying
be
contract.
Swamped, just know yeah. in a second. I know there's not many people here, but you may be swamped.
Yeah, so she goes through line by line and makes sure that there's nothing scary, nothing horrible that's hiding in these contracts, and there always is. So that's another thing, is really looking at that contract and yeah. seeing what you're obliged to do and what they can get away with. Because they always sneak something in they can get away with yeah. that suddenly you haven't got rights to something or other.
Get those contracts checked. Now, I want to ask, before we run out of time, are there questions in the audience? Just raise your hand and Ruby will bring a microphone. Please ask away. Oh, one up there, fantastic.
You all mentioned reading your reviews, and lucky you having no negative ones. Once you've seen the book on the shelf, John, I know you're standing the other side of the store, but you can still reach it from there. Can you read it? Can you read it once it's actually printed?
God, no. No. I have had to read sections of it to prepare for doing readings. But no, I feel like I've read the damn thing so many times in the lead up to publication that I felt no compulsion to actually read it word for word after it had gone to print, because it's kind of too late. Like, what's done yeah. is done. It's out there. It's just time to move on. And it's interesting how in a way you feel like the big wins happen along the way, and publication day or publication is often a bit of a total anticlimax, because the real excitement is when you've done that contract and you've finished an edit, and you know, publication day is literally when the printers finish their job and the trucks have taken it into the shops, I think.
What about you, Ashley?
I was always surprised when authors said that they couldn't read it after it came out, but I found that, I think it's because you have this so long where you just constantly change it and you have that freedom to change any of it at any time. Yeah. And then all of a sudden it's printed and you can't change it. And that's a different reaction. But I've actually had to, particularly essays, go back and remind myself of some of the details in there before I speak about it, just because I have a chronic illness and my memory is affected and I can't hold it all in my head anymore. So I've found that time made that easier.
Yeah.
So, and now I can again.
Did you ever have to do readings for Secret Life of Emma?
Thankfully, no.
No, no. That would be odd.
No, that would be very odd. I won't go near them. Largely because I just want to work on them. Like I want to fix bits up and make it better. And
yeah, so I just constantly edit if I'm doing readings, and because I'm often doing it in schools, and you can see the kids going, that's not what it says. That's not it. But I also, because I haven't been able to listen to the audiobook either, and the voice actor who did my audiobook contacted me and said, you know, that she was so overwhelmed to read it and they had to stop it a lot because she was crying. And she said, did you like it? And I was like, oh, yes. It's wonderful. But I can't listen to it. Can't listen.
I think she's now going to find out.
Yeah, that's true. We don't have that big reach yet. She's in the UK. Okay. Thank you. Great question. Other questions that people want to ask over here? This is, can I just introduce you all to Anna Downs, whose book is coming out next year?
Yes.
2020. Thank you for coming along.
Of course. Thank you. Cassie, so much of what you were saying about writing as a new mum or with young children really resonated with me. And one of the things that I've been struggling with is making the transition psychologically and emotionally and logistically from, you know, going from being somebody that just wrote for myself or just, you know, fit writing time in the wee hours of the morning and, you know, when the kids are asleep and la la la, to being somebody that now has a job and deadlines. And I think that, yeah, that's a really big thing for me. So to hear you talk about that is both comforting and I'm like, tell me how you're doing it.
Give us the secret.
There's no secret. So at the moment I'm full-time writing So I sit down at my desk once the kids are off at school and I write between 9 and 2. And so I guess I'm really lucky at the moment to be in that position to devote the time to it. But I know of many women who do have to juggle jobs, kids, writing. It's bloody hard. It really is so difficult. I think in the end, my choice was to not have much money, which is a choice I'm very lucky to be able to make. I appreciate that that most people have to have the day job, which is incredibly difficult. I think you have to be very kind to yourself. You do what you can. You do your best. At the end of the day, it's more important to me to be a good person, to be available to my kids and my family. I love writing. It's very important, but it's not the total sum of who I am as well. So yeah, that's just the way that I try to appreciate it. I don't feel like it's really answered your question necessarily, but
it's the eternal question. We're going to finish up with a book recommendation, and I will add my own book recommendation in here. Have you read The Divided Heart, which is edited by Rachel Powers, and it's fantastic. They re-released, I think Affirm Press re-released it a couple of years ago, and it's a series of essays or interviews with creative women about how they are dealing with the tensions in their lives. So highly recommend it. Great across writers and musicians and various people. I don't know if Glee Books has it, but they should. That is where we are going to stick around. There's books up there to purchase, and the people here will sign them. As I said, mine didn't quite arrive here on time, but you can put it on order, I'm sure. But before I let you go, I asked you to come up with a debut recommendation, because this is part of the podcast and I make people recommend us books. Part of the reason we are here is because of bookshops and the incredible job that bookshops do, and particularly independent bookstores. So if you can walk out of here tonight with a few books in your bag, that would be best. What are you going to recommend? Favourite debut ever, any time, any genre? Cassie?
I'm going to recommend Toni Jordan's Edition.
Ooh. Good one.
It's a few years old now, but God, I just loved it. It was really funny. The voice is incredible. It's basically a romantic comedy, but it really did open my eyes to the way that you can say something quite profound, but in a light kind of way. And I just think she's a remarkable writer in the way that she's been able to straddle different genres, and she gives back to the writing community, and she's really an amazing teacher. And I actually had the chance to do a workshop with her this year, and I took my little dog-eared copy of Edition and she signed it, and I gave her a copy of my book, and it was just one of those full circle kind of lovely moments. So yeah, I still have that book. I actually don't keep a lot of books at home, but hers is one that will never leave my shelf.
No, and you can listen back to Toni Jordan. She was the first ever person I approached to be on the podcast. Yeah. So she's in season one. Ashley.
Julie Coe is a Sydney-based writer, and her short story collection, Portable Curiosities, which is just the best title, just like bright and colourful and resonant and fascinating, and it just sticks in my mind all the time. Like, I've read lots of short story collections where I cannot tell you what happens in a single short story like 6 months later, but I'll always remember Julie Coe's stories because they're so bright and vivid and amazing. So
she's amazing. She was actually on my wish list for tonight, and we gorgeously spoke on Twitter and she wasn't available. The other thing to check out of Julie Coe's is that incredible speech she did to launch Emerging Writers Festival in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic satire, and you've got to get your hands on it. I'll link in our show notes. Thank you, John.
Well, in the podcast this morning, I mentioned Cash 22, but you mentioned Robert Lucan, so I'm going to go with Everlasting Sunday, because when you I interviewed him, and he is the book.
He really is.
Like, when people say, oh, this is written in a different way, it's because the man has drowned himself in the best literature of history, like going right back. And when I look at it, because I stalked him and went on to Goodreads and went down the list, and I was impressed at this long list of classics. And when I spoke to him in the podcast, he speaks like someone who's just been dusted off from the 1950s.
He really does.
That's the earliest I could think of. I mean, the latest I could think of him being dug out. and the book is a wonderful book, and the language in it is it's a great reminder of what language can do, and it's definitely worth persevering with it, because at first you may go, oh wait, this sounds a bit too, but no, it's consistent the whole way through, and what he does for adolescent boys, you get all this bad press for adolescent boys, and these are boys in the worst conditions, and it is so much love in this book, which is just gorgeous. So that's Everlasting Sunday. Yeah,
fantastic. And another shout out before we finish up, because there's another author in the audience, Petronella McGovern, whose book 6 Minutes should be available right here in Glee Books, so you could get yourself a copy of that too. Thank you all so much for coming this evening. It was, as we said, an experiment for us, and it's so delightful to have people in the room. Thank you, John, Ashley and Cassie, for... I hope you didn't feel like I completely hypnotised you. You haven't spilled any terrible secrets for being here. And to Glee Books, to Ruby, thank you for looking after us. We are going to be... Well, these lovely authors here are going to be signing their books up at the back there. Stick around, have wine... have a chat to us. We're not at all scary. And thank you again so much for coming. You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first and second time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe 80. The First Time Podcast is supported by Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre, RMIT School of Media and Communication, and by our wonderful supporters on Patreon. You too can become a supporter of our podcast by heading to our Patreon site, www.patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast.